to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about mental health on the show today and focusing on, to begin the show at least, on how you can build your self-confidence. And who better to help us with that than Dr. Shyla Morgain? She's a distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She specializes in using mind-body medicine to treat mood and anxiety disorders, injury rehabilitation, and a whole lot more in athletes. She is also a sports psychologist to UW Badger student athletes. And as we talk with Dr. Morgain, I hope you join in. How'd you put an end to negative self-talk? Maybe, or get rid of that imposter syndrome. Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Shyla Morgain, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Self-confidence. How do psychologists define self-confidence?
Well, confidence is at its heart believing in yourself, and from that belief, acting in a way that really honors your self-worth. So you might be advocating for yourself, speaking up, taking care of yourself, forming good social relationships, and feeling a sense of peace and calm because you know you're enough. And when we look at studies estimate that 85% of Americans experience low self-esteem, and we see a similar percentage worldwide. And when I look at my practice and working with clients, I would say the majority of people don't feel good enough. And when we have that low self-esteem, it can impact us. We can have self-doubt. We can have a negative self-perception. And it can impact our relationships and our social interactions.
Yeah. I mentioned the imposter syndrome. Maybe you could talk about what it is. And is it the same thing as low self-confidence?
Well, low self-confidence or low self-esteem can permeate all aspects of one's life, like feeling good enough to get a job or a promotion or in a relationship or kids studying for school. When I think of imposter syndrome, I think of somebody who is in maybe a new job or somebody going off to college, and you are comparing yourself against everyone, and you feel like you simply don't measure up, that people perceive you as being more competent than you actually feel. And people trust their feeling versus maybe their potential. And what I want to talk to you about is confidence is a skill, and sometimes that feeling of not being good enough, actually, the majority of times, it's not true because we have much more potential than we even realize. And just because you can't do it today doesn't mean you won't be able to do it tomorrow or the week ahead or month ahead. So if confidence is a skill, we can talk about some of those skills. We can really work on it to grow ourselves into the people that we want to become and that we're capable of being.
I am sure at some point or another I've gone through that kind of imposter syndrome myself. Do you think most of us do at one point or another?
Absolutely. If we're not playing it safe, if we're growing out of our comfort zone, I can imagine you, Larry, when you started this show, or you know, I can relate when I started grad school, there's a feeling that we don't measure up, we're not enough, we're not somehow not worthy of success, and that we can keep ourselves small. We can keep ourselves in that comfort zone. And one author talks about the upper limit problem, that the one problem to solve is our upper limit. And when we grow out, we go beyond that upper limit. I think of a video game and we go to the next level. It's uncomfortable. We may not have all the skills needed, but that doesn't mean we can't learn them. So, you know, we can think about when we feel that imposter syndrome, feelings aren't facts. Just because we feel like, hey, maybe I don't have what it takes, that feeling isn't a fact, isn't true. And I would say for everyone, we're much more capable than we even realize. But sometimes we give up too quickly. We don't get the support we need. We don't take action and work on things to grow to that next level, to up level, to get to the outside that comfort zone.
Yeah. I was lucky. I had parents who didn't overly praise me, but they certainly let me know that they had plenty of confidence in me and were willing to give me some free rein to have the confidence in me to do that. I wonder if how you sort of are raised has a difference, makes a difference in your self-confidence.
Yeah, that's a great point. Sometimes parents inadvertently can reduce confidence if they praise their child for, or overly praise that child for winning, getting the A, getting first place. That can put a lot of pressure on kids. That can create some dissonance. Hey, mom and dad, thinks I'm the best, but actually I don't feel like I'm that. So I always encourage parents to praise effort, not outcome, to praise the hard work. And sometimes there's a helicopter parent that overly does things for their children, so they don't learn that some of the skill sets. So I also encourage parents to give permission for their children to make mistakes, to fail sometimes, to try different things, and in praising the effort, problem solving. Okay, yeah, you didn't do so well on that test, but what can you do differently next time? How do you stick with a task and keep at it to learn and grow to be able to master it? Sometimes giving children something to work on mastery is really important. And I think most important also for ourselves, for our children, for even our communities, is learning to talk kindly to ourselves. What we find is that self-compassion, being kind to ourselves, creates a much more stable sense of self than praising the outcome, than wanting to win, wanting to be the best. So some days, yeah, we're going to do that, but a lot of days we're not. And then we feel like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe other people perceive me this way, but I'm not measuring up. So kindness, talking to yourself kindly, giving yourself grace, and really trying to stick with something, even if it takes time and time and time again, eventually we'll succeed.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned parents. Are there other certain life events that often lower people's self-confidence?
Well, I think a lot of things. I think just the society we live in, there's a lot of messaging in media that we're not good enough. We need to buy this product, do this different thing, work on this till we'll finally, it's kind of like a carrot dangling. We'll finally get good enough if we do all these things, only to know the line has moved and we're still not good enough. So I think there's a lot of messaging in our culture. I do think, you know, sometimes in schools, people can, there's social pressure to look a certain way. And if you're not, you're shamed. For some people, they've been bullied and they've internalized that. And sometimes, you know, somebody can be in a sport or an activity where somebody's a winner and others are a loser, only to feel like, oh, I didn't win, so therefore I must be a loser. Not just I lost, but I must be a loser. So I think there are a lot of forces that we have grown up with and still have that kind of make us feel like, oh, you know, I'm low on confidence.
Yeah.
I don't have what it takes.
So low self-confidence, I guess, could be a learned behavior. And I imagine at the same time, confidence could be a learned behavior as well. If you're low confidence, you can learn to have better self-confidence.
Absolutely. I think of my daughter who's three, who did soccer. Three-year-old soccer is pretty fun to watch.
I remember those days. I remember those days.
And the beginning of class, the coach has the kids say, try your best and believe in yourself. And it's been fun to see these little three-year-olds adopt that as a mantra, try your best and believe in yourself. So yes, confidence, you know, we can think about how do we instill it early on in our children. But as adults, I think a lot of us have some healing to do around building up our confidence. So way deep inside, we feel good enough. No matter how we're doing on a particular day, at our core, we feel we're enough, we're deserving, we have what it takes.
Let's talk about maybe some day-to-day strategies you can use to improve your confidence. First, I'm sure self-talk plays a big role in your confidence.
Yeah,
what is self-talk? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I really want to highlight confidence is a skill we can strengthen. So one, paying attention to our own inner voice. I think a lot of us grew up thinking if I beat myself up, if I criticize myself, I'm going to go farther, further, I'm going to learn. And we actually find that negative self-talk erodes confidence. It diminishes how we feel about ourselves. So I think number one is be kind to yourself. You can think about somebody you care about who's struggling, how you might talk to him or her. You can think about somebody who cares about you, what they might say to you. So having some grace for foibles, failures, mistakes, think about, there may be something to learn from that of what you do differently or what you need to work on, but focus on, being kind, and then what is possible. So what you, again, might say to a child who's struggling on a particular day might help them problem solve, but encouraging them and having them try again and really believing in their potential. I think that same kind of self-talk. So you could do thought stopping. When you have a negative self-thought, say stop, or you can see a stop sign, or people clap their hands or snap a little rubber band on their wrist to stop, and then choose a different thought that promotes peace of mind, makes you feel good, kind of like that inner cheerleader. That is powerful.
Yeah, I was thinking about my golf game. There are a couple of places on the particular golf courses where I've done really well. I hit a great shot. And I try to channel that when I'm at other spots where I haven't had that good of luck. So I guess I'm talking to myself there and saying, well, remember how you hit that 165 yards across that big chasm, without any trouble? This is the same thing. This is the same thing. Just do it.
Yeah, and Larry, you're using a second technique that's powerful, which is what I call the flip back, flick forward. So everyone's had past successes. You had that hitting the 165 yards across the fairway. That is kind of like a highlight reel moment for you with golf. So we've all had that, a time where you did well or even turned out better than expected. You had something go wrong, but you resolved it. So you can flick back in time, remember it, relive it with some visualization, re-experience it almost like virtual reality, and then come into the moment. So you flick forward, seeing yourself having a similar, if not better, outcome. What's powerful about that is we trust our past experiences more than that negative self-talk in the moment. So if you find you're really getting ruminative, you're beating yourself up, do that flick back, flick forward, flick back to a time that went well or turned out better than expected, and then flick forward, seeing yourself having a similar, if not better, outcome. That can really override negative self-talk because you've had some of those past successes. And I encourage whenever something does go well, add it to that highlights reel. Kind of re-experience it, remember it, say, okay, that's my personal highlights reel I can carry forward.
Dr. Shyla Morgain, our guest today, as we talk with her about self-confidence. And you can join in. I haven't given the number. Well, let me do it right now. Here's how you join us. 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at 11:30, our topic is traumatic brain injuries. Right now, though, we're visiting with Dr. Shyla Morgain about building your self-confidence. And again, you can join 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. One of your suggestions is to speak up and use your voice. And what do you mean by that?
Absolutely. Sometimes we can keep ourselves small by not participating, becoming invisible, and by actually using your voice, saying something, participating, speaking up, that is really important. So you can think about maybe those people who are in school raising your hand and saying something. If you're meeting at work, participating, bringing up one point. I think of studies that show in a meeting that has both men and women, women are much like much less likely to say something until one woman participates. When one woman participates, other women will start to participate. So be that person who participates. Mm-hmm. Even with family or friends, finding ways to make your voice heard, even if you're nervous, even if your voice is quivering, our voices are a way of expressing ourselves. So even just trying to say one thing, if, for example, if you're in the workplace, goes a long way, because we find that in the workplace, people get promoted not necessarily because of how well they're doing, but because they're advocating for themselves, they're pitching their ideas, they're asking for the raise. Think about just even challenging yourself. I have that a lot with my student athletes in class. Just say one thing. So the more you practice, the easier it will become. And I think that speaks to just taking action. We don't become confident by just sitting on our hands, it's by using your voice or taking action.
Robert in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. This is a fascinating interview, and I'm listening intently as I'm driving south on 43. So, question I was actually going to ask about, I'm in my mid-70s, and about athletes aging and lacking self-confidence, but the more I thought about it, I have another question about self-confidence. I'm trying to start writing, memoirs, my life memoirs, and I lack confidence in writing, and I get, not writer's block, but I just get kind of stuck. Any suggestions? And is there a good app for writing biographies or autobiographies?
Shiloh, what do you think?
Oh, thank you. You bring up two great points. I think with writing, we can have the inner critic right alongside while we're writing. So they say for writing, to first think about putting all your thoughts down on paper. That's not the time to edit. That's time just for idea generation. So really giving yourself permission, no matter how silly or far-fetched, just to put it down on paper, number two, you might have a trusted person who could be a cheerleader, who could even send you a note saying, great, that's wonderful, tell me your ideas. That could be part of that supportive companion. And only once you have your ideas down to then go back and do some of that editing. And I think with writing, along with other goals, it can be really powerful to work towards a larger purpose. When I hear about memoirs, and you might have family members or friends you want to share some of your life experiences with, that is a strong mission. So when we do something for that larger purpose, for others, then it matters less if we're scared. When we think about that positive difference and courage, that positive difference we can make, our courage is strengthened, because those words you're writing are going to contribute to maybe your grandkids or even great-grandkids. So it'll contribute to the well-being of others, and that can strengthen courage. And you mentioned being an athlete later in life, and I think sometimes we can compare ourselves with, how we were when we were 40, or either other athletes who might be a decade younger. But I think about when we think about lifelong learning, that even if our body's aging, there's still part of us, they call it generativity, that's becoming more enlivened, that is learning and growing, then sometimes a goal like maybe working towards a race or staying in shape, that can really help us say, hey, there's still part of me that's that lifelong learner, that's strengthening, that's growing, that can really fuel that commitment, that action, that engagement in that task. That can be part of that confidence we're strengthening.
Yeah, good advice there. Robert, good luck with your writing. Call us back at some point. Let us know how it's gone. I'd appreciate it. You know, we can't get away without talking about the power pose, which you wrote about. And I thought, well, I'm going to try that. And I did. And it was really interesting. Why is that a good strategy to feel more confident? And what is it?
Yeah, Amy Cuddy has a great TED Talk on this. And the research, follow-up research, other people haven't necessarily replicated her findings, but I still like to talk about it. It's called the Superman or Superhero Pose. I actually personally do it before public speaking. I have a lot of my athletes do it before a race. And it's simply standing up, having your feet apart, and then creating some space. So you can, I usually put my hands on my hips while I'm standing and my feet are hip distance apart. Or even in a meeting, you're sitting, you can think about maybe putting your arms behind your head. Men tend to do this more than women, or just creating some space in your body. Take up physical space. The research with Amy Cuddy said people did that for 2 minutes. And then when they came in for a mock job interview, they were rated as having more presence. They were more likely to get hired in this mock job interview than people who didn't do the power pose. So if you're feeling you're having to go into, let's say, a difficult meeting or a job interview or a presentation and you're feeling nervous, if you go and make your body having more physical presence with this power pose, one is going to, I think personally, I find it calming my nerves. You're feeling embodied, and then people will perceive you as maybe having more confidence than you actually do. So try it out. And it's great, Larry. It sounds like it worked for you.
Yeah. And while you were talking about it, Lee Rayburn and I both stood up and raised our microphones up, and we did it, but only for a minute and or less. So the 2 minutes, and I think it would even help the writer, you know, just get you in the right mood.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, it can be helpful in so many different things.
Oh, Shyla, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Let's do it again soon. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was a joy to be with you today.
Dr. Shyla Morgain, distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She's got my self-confidence up. I hope she's got yours up. We're going to turn our attention, though, to another kind of a serious matter, traumatic brain injuries and the impact they can have on your life or mine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for being with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to traumatic brain injuries and the impact they can have on our lives and on our loved ones' lives today. And our guest to talk about it, it's great to have Jamie Nemeth with us. She's a registered nurse and the unit manager for the Clearview Brain Injury Center in Juneau, Wisconsin. So it's great to have Jamie along, and as we talk with her, I want to hear from you. Tell us about your own experiences with traumatic brain injuries, maybe a loved one, maybe yourself. How have you or a loved one coped with the injury? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jamie Nemeth, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What's to begin with, how's a traumatic brain injury defined? What is one?
Well, so traumatic brain injury can be anything, you know, that really where the brain suffers an injury. So most commonly falls, motor vehicle accidents, assault, sports injuries, you know, things like that where, you know, you take a hard hit to the head. There's also acquired brain injuries, which we see here too, where there's like hypoxic events or stroke, you know, things like that, where it's not an actual, you know, hit to the head. So
And how's the brain affected? I assume differently depending on the way it happens.
Oh, absolutely. So, every brain injury is different. We see a lot of variabilities here. So mainly, your physical mobility, walking, ability to bathe and dress yourself. It depends on the severity, too. But cognitive skills, speech, language, memory, even eating and swallowing, those are all things that can be impacted. Obviously, in our world here at the Brain Injury Center, we take care of more moderate to severe brain injury. Mild injuries oftentimes are able to go home from the hospital or, whatever setting that they are in, to begin with.
Yeah. I read somewhere it was in 2023, more than 13,000 Wisconsinites visited an emergency department for a traumatic brain injury. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think the world really doesn't know how common brain injury is, because especially like for those who aren't impacted by their mobility, if it's just cognitive and language, sometimes, you can have a conversation with somebody and they seem totally fine, but not really realize, what the impairments are with executive functioning, their memory, things like that, that really you need to get through your day.
Yeah. Well, let's say you fall and you hit your head. When do you know it's time to see a doctor?
Well, if you start noticing, any changes, in vision or dizziness, if one side of your body becomes more weak or tingly or, anything like that. Another thing people notice, change in speech, so if your friends are like, okay, well, I'm not understanding you, definitely need to go in for an evaluation.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that part. Bill in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Bill, hi.
Hi. I suffered from a traumatic brain injury. It was a subdural and full brain bleed. They didn't expect me to live, as a matter of fact. And this was from a low blood sugar. I went down to the Grand Mal seizure into a sidewalk. And I was in Germany. They took me in, induced me into a coma. It was that severe. I came out of it, and that was 1999. And it's been tough because I've lost jobs. Memory's a big one. I've come a long way. I mean, it's pretty amazing, but it's a hidden injury now. People don't see it. I mean, even the motor vehicle department let me go because they said, you don't go fast enough. You just kind of stop and then you start again. They said, that's the brain injury. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Jamie, a comment on Bill.
Yeah, it sounds like you're doing fantastic, though, Bill. I mean, it's amazing, and especially being in a different country, I can't imagine what that must have been like.
Yeah, it must have been very, very tough. But Bill, I'll just go to you, back to you for a second. It's not only mental, or it's not only physical, but it's kind of mental, the part of it. Have you been able to deal with that, and how have you dealt with that?
Yeah, definitely. I have epilepsy now. They put me on seizure meds. The first ones put me into a suicidal mode. It was horrible. And it took a lot. The biggest thing is people always said, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. It was the worst thing anybody could say. It was tough. I mean, I was in the commercial interior architecture field. I can't do it anymore. I can process and do anything you can hear with my talking, but the problem is I'll remember stuff from conversations 2 days later, and I just couldn't process fast enough. So three different architecture firms let me go.
Yeah.
And so I'm suffering now. I have a part-time job and I'm on disability, but it's tough. I have a job, fortunately, and I have my moments. People just don't understand. It's unfortunate.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Any other words of encouragement for Bill, Jamie?
Well, I think, you know, it's great that you did go back into the working field. It is tough. And, you know, there are programs in place to help with that for people who suffer with brain injury. So I know it's frustrating not being back at the level, you know, that you once were, but I encourage you to keep going at it.
What in your own work, Jamie, you know, you obviously we can't talk about individual people, but what is a typical process for you to deal with in your center? I mean, here you've got the Cleveland Brain Injury Center in Juneau. What's the process that your group goes through, you or your other colleagues go through?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, it starts with a referral, you know, so we work with any hospital in and out of state. You know, they refer people here who have the brain injuries, either traumatic or acquired. And so we have to go through, you know, make sure that we can take them, you know, that they have an appropriate diagnosis. And then, you know, it goes through triaging, you know, like what kind of needs that those people have. Once somebody is approved to come here, you know, there's the whole financial screening. There's a lot that really goes into it. And we're lucky in Wisconsin to have such a supportive area within Medicaid and all of those resources for brain injury. So there's good coverage with that here. Our program then, everybody gets 5 to 5.5 hours a week of physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. And then we also have recreational therapy here in-house. We have neuropsychology services. We have psychiatry. We have physical medicine and rehab who come in. And everybody is assigned their own kind of case manager. They're called the rehab specialists. So they have a relatively small caseload because it's so complex. So that makes my job a little bit easier because they're managing, you know, all of the family and social service basic needs, you know, and then I can handle the medical end of things and communicating with the doctors and, you know, all of the outside appointments, because there's obviously a lot of specialties that go along with the brain injury. So our program, you know, goes up to 12 months typically. Sometimes, you know, people are here a little bit longer if they are benefiting from the therapy based on, you know, who their funding source is, what their needs are, and then what the discharge needs look like after that. Sometimes people only need to stay, you know, a couple weeks, and that's definitely not as common because brain injury can take a long time. And even after people leave here, there's still healing that takes place. It's just, we want to capture the best amount of rehab in that first year after traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, I suppose that's very important. Early on, getting attacking the problems. And then I think teaching people, and at the same time you're teaching people how to deal with their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. There's a lot of resources that go along with it, you know, and both with the mental health piece, you know, for the individuals, some individuals aren't even aware, you know, of the deficits because it's just the brain is so complex. Some people, as they, you know, gain awareness of that, you know, depression sets in, you know, there are different medical components that come into play, you know, like Bill had talked about, you know, the epilepsy, seizures, you know, that's very common after brain injury, you know, so then going through different medications and things like that and how that works with each individual, it can be pretty hard to navigate through.
Yeah. Bill, thanks again. Barb in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Barb.
Hello. My mother had a traumatic brain injury because she had 3 brain tumors, each 10 years apart, benign, in different locations of her brain. She had 4 children, 17 years apart. So what I've noticed, as she is now passed at the age of 89, we all thought it was a miracle that she survived, and we still do. But very realistically, to have that kind of brain trauma, it affected every relationship in her life. With short-term memory problems, she could not keep up with the little things that were happening with her children's lives and with her friends' lives. And so little by little, her friends kind of drifted off. With one of them, she had a right frontal lobe, which really changed her behavior and gave her angry outbursts and further fractured relationships. So I have a lot of empathy to people who are supporting loved ones who have had traumatic brain injury because it is so hard on relationships.
Barb, thank you for calling. Comment, Jamie?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It is really hard because people also don't understand that. You know, the behavior changes, as you mentioned, that's very significant. It impacts even, you know, relationships between, you know, children and their parents or, you know, their significant others, their spouse. And so we, you know, provide resources for them. Our neuropsychologists meet with family members to help explain that. And then provide also, you know, additional resources outside of our facility for them to, you know, seek counseling or group supports and things like that.
Barb, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Jamie Nemeth, a registered nurse and the unit manager for the Clearview Brain Injury Center in Juneau, as we talk about preventing and caring for traumatic brain injuries. And again, you can join us. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's turn to an email here. Dennis emailed us. Brain and neck injuries can be simultaneous and both can cause vertigo. If brain injuries aren't fully relieved, neck injuries can be treated and decrease vertigo. Comment on that?
So it's not often we have both a combination with the neck injuries and the head injuries. I mean, we do see that. But we have physical therapy in-house who can provide the vertigo treatments. So they do specific techniques to help get those connections back functioning within, you know, the small bones in the ears and everything that works together in that limbic system. Vertigo can be very tough. We have a lot of patients who struggle with that after brain injury.
Yeah. And at noon today, we're going to be talking with an audiologist about hearing health. And so some of that may come up. I know we'll talk about tinnitus, but there'll be other things that we discuss on the auditory side of it as well. Cindy in Green Bay emailed us. Cindy has had a nasty fall in the winter of 2017, needed vision therapy, physical therapy for balance and eye tracking, focus for quite a while. She was very concerned about her ability to recall and learn. She took an online class titled Learning How to Learn, which helped reassure her that she could learn, retain, and recall. Currently, she plays online word games of the New York Times and SET to keep things limber. Sometimes baby steps are the best steps. What do you think?
That's absolutely great. I mean, really, doing anything cognitive like that. I know there's a lot of technology now, too, with apps and stuff on phones and tablets. Our speech therapy department utilizes some of those. I couldn't name any right now, but they can be really helpful for regaining that cognitive awareness and build up your memory. It just helps build up those pathways again.
Just going back to the start of an injury, John wonders, he's heard that you shouldn't fall asleep after hitting your head. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure on that piece. Most of our treatment, you know, these are severe injuries. There's a lot of research on concussion, you know, so I think that's more so what he's referring to. Yes, I mean, because if you go to sleep, you're not going to know how severe it is. A lot of people with the moderate to severe injuries lose consciousness because of the rate of what the bleeding is occurring or the swelling in the brain. So you need that evaluation time to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking of our earlier caller who said he was put into an induced coma, so actually put to sleep. Bo in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bo.
Hi. Yeah, my brain injury was a couple decades ago, and afterwards it was really bad. I had migraines, severe migraines for a couple years, and I I was in a bike accident. The guy hit me. I was, you know, in my lane and everything, but he just swerved and accidentally hit me, and it was a hit and run. So I didn't have very good insurance at the time, and they actually never did an MRI. I went to, like, the local public health clinic, and they treated me. I have two questions. So one of the major after effects was an inner ear injury. So it left me with pretty much lifelong intermittent vertigo, and then some balance issues. Like, I'll probably never get on a bike again.
Okay.
But two of my questions is, when you have, do you recommend any specific therapy for the inner ear injury when people have them? And also, do you recommend periodic MRIs to kind of look at your brain to see what the health is like? Or what can I do to just maintain? I had a really good doctor, and she really gave me really good care, like aftercare and what to do. So that helped. I don't get the migraines as much anymore. But I'm kind of just thinking about the long term, because I have heard that brain injury heightens your risk of dementia and things like that. So,
sure. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Bo, for calling. I'm sorry for the accident. But Jamie, comments?
Yeah. So, you know, as far as the vestibular stuff goes with the vertical, you know, I'm not really sure on, you know, being that far out, you know, what treatment looks like. I know, you know, like I said, physical therapy can do a lot of vestibular treatment, but I guess it's case by case. So I'm not sure. I would talk to the doctor about that. As for, you know, repeat MRIs, you know, that isn't typically recommended unless there's a further decline. You know, in our setting, you know, we're dealing with more acute situations. And so you're, you know, being years out from the initial injury, it probably wouldn't tell you much. But if you did notice, you know, that things are declining in any area, a neurologist definitely would be able to step in and, you know, pick up those early signs of dementia.
Bo, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Leah emailed us. Her father-in-law has a serious TBI. Becomes hard to be around him, especially with my young child, because cognitively he can range from being 6 or 60 years old in a matter of a conversation, in terms of, you know, saying inappropriate things. Any advice on how to be around someone like this when you know their brain is not 100%, but don't want to expose your child to inappropriate behavior or speech?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because really, you know, cognition can fluctuate that quickly in some individuals with those severe injuries. There's really nothing you can do to prevent what they're going to say, you know, or what you're going to do. So I think the biggest thing, you know, is kind of maybe keeping a distance, you know, from your child, from that situation, or, you know, come up with some sort of technique like, okay, well, why don't you go over here now when you know that something inappropriate is going to come out. Yeah, there's really, really not much, you know, that can be done to prevent those comments.
Yeah. This whole business about depression, there has to be a link, I would think, between traumatic brain injuries and depression.
There is. You know, I don't know. That's way above my degree as far as, like, all of the chemical balances and the different hormones and stuff in the brain. But I do know with working with the psychiatrists over the years, people with brain injury are more susceptible to depression. They said that it is just a matter of that, the chemicals and the hormones, and the different, you know, balances with that. But also because of the changes in what your life, you know, is, you know, you don't return to 100% after a moderate to severe brain injury.
No. And probably it's never going to happen for the person. Well, what are some general, I mean, it's already come up a few times with really loved ones talking about others in their family. How can loved ones help or provide support as someone recovers from a traumatic brain injury?
Well, you know, in the acute setting, I think, you know, being there, whether that person, you know, with the brain injury has the awareness, you know, of who they are or, you know, what what even year it is, you know, having somebody there to show that they're not alone, I think is very significant. As time goes on, it's helpful. It's really helpful, actually, for the caregivers, you know, in our situation, for families who have been there. We get a lot of information from those families or friends or loved ones, whatever, who have been, you know, at their bedside since the very beginning to know, you know, if things are, if something is worsening or, you know, what something looked like at the beginning. You know, say there's a lot of physical problems. Dystonia is a really common problem with brain injury. So that's tightening of the muscles. It's just in involuntary tightness of the muscles. So people can develop contractures and things. It's helpful to know, you know, what that looks like early on and what it's looking like now, or, you know, something that they were saying early on, or, you know, seizure-like activities. You know, it's really helpful for us. Long-term, though, I think having that support to be an advocate for a person with brain injury is really important. You know, they can help navigate the world, you know, whether they go home or to a group home, you know, or CBRF, something like that. They can help that individual gain the most independence.
Yeah. Well, here we are coming up to the fall sports season and school again. Kids might be participating in football or lacrosse or soccer. What's the best way to prevent injury in these contact sports? What are some precautions to take?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing with that, you know, obviously those contact sports, there's always risk of it. Schools are required, you know, to educate on the importance of that. All of the athletes have to sign an agreement, you know, that they read and understand that and that they're going to report their symptoms. Now, going along with that, it's important to listen to the coach, to learn the proper mechanics of whatever they're doing, you know, whether it be football or basketball, wrestling, to know what's okay and what's not okay, you know, to do during that sporting event. And to take that, you know, advice if the coach is noticing something that you're doing that isn't safe. You know, it's really important to listen to that.
And proper headgear.
Mm-hmm. Yep, of course, any biking, football, any contact sports like that, you know, they're going to make you wear your helmet. Prevention, you know, even on your way to the sporting events, make sure to wear a seatbelt. We take care of so many folks who are ejected from their vehicles, and, you know, some of that could be prevented.
Is that right? People are not using their seatbelts?
Mm-hmm. I know. You think it's 2025, and there's been enough accidents and things, you know, that people see in the news, but no, it's still a problem.
Well, I was thinking back to my visit with Fred Risser last week, where I think it was 1975 before I think we got seatbelts as a required requirement, and there was a big fight about it the whole way. So I guess it's not surprising that some people don't do it. Well, in the last 30 seconds, what's your advice to folks who are living with someone or who have suffered a brain injury?
You know, I think it's just important to understand that, you know, whether, you know, personality, behavior, you know, cognitive abilities or physical changes, those changes aren't at the fault of the individual. The brain is a very complex thing. And so, you know, if it's a problem with, you know, like, between a loved one, you know, in their relationship or, you know, a child and their parent, that individual isn't meaning to do those things. You know, It really changes. It really changes people, and it's out of their control. You know, so that's the biggest thing to remember.
Well, Jamie, you're doing some wonderful work there as unit manager for Clearview Brain Injury Center in Juneau, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Jamie Nemeth is a registered nurse and the unit manager of Clearview Brain Injury Center in Juneau. And you could look them up on their website. Look forward to that. Look forward to talking about your ear health coming up after our news break. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to ear and hearing health on the show today with our guest, Dr. Brent Fisher. He is with Essential Health in Duluth, Minnesota. He's an audiologist who helps patients with many hearing issues, and it's great to talk with him today. And as we talk with Dr. Fisher, want to hear from you. Let us know how you cope with tinnitus, perhaps, or give us your questions about hearing loss. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Brent Fisher, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be here.
You're an audiologist. What kinds of things do you do to help your patients?
Well, we evaluate their hearing and talk to them about safe practices to protect their hearing, to reduce the risk of hearing loss. If we identify any problems, we talk to them about maybe changes that they can make to minimize those problems. We talk to them about strategic communication so that they can hear and communicate more effectively. And we provide them with options such as hearing devices and implantable devices so that they can communicate more effectively with their loved ones and in their work and in their community. We also evaluate patients who have ear ringing or tinnitus and dizziness, help them with their balance and other related issues.
Steve in Ironwood, Michigan has something relating to tinnitus you mentioned. Let's go there. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've had tinnitus. People say tinnitus or tinnitus for about 8 to 10 years. During the day, it's okay. And when you're doing things, it's there, but you're not aware of it. But trying to sleep at night makes it tough. And also, I actually had a specialist tell me some people get it so bad they commit suicide. I can't believe a doctor would tell me that.
Steve, that's an interesting comment. Dr. Brent Fisher, a comment?
Well, thanks for that question. Yeah, that's a great point. Steven mentions that you can pronounce it either way. Tinnitus or tinnitus is fine. And that it's not uncommon for individuals to experience this during the day. They may not be as aware of it. And typically during the day, we're often in environments with other sounds. The background of sound tends to mask or cover up the presence of ear ringing or a sound perception in the absence of other external acoustic stimulus, which how we define tinnitus. And tinnitus can be subjective, which is in cases where it's just heard by the patient or the individual. And in some cases, it can be objective. This is somewhat more rare, but where other people can actually hear a sound that's being generated within the body. But during the day, it's typical for patients to have less bothersome tinnitus. They don't notice it as much because there's more going on, and not just in terms of sound. They may be distracted by their work or things that they're seeing or other sensory information that they're taking in. But at night, it's quiet. You're trying to rest, and the brain, which is attending to different stimuli in the environment, maybe is more distracted by the presence of a sound. And so that is pretty typical. We talk to patients a lot about different strategies they can use to manage tinnitus at night. And some patients will find using different sound therapies, like having a background sound on at a very low level. For example, patients might use a white noise machine at a low level or a fan, or having some background noise will decrease that perception of the tinnitus as being as bothersome. And Stephen's comment about some individuals being very bothered about this is accurate. Maybe less than 2%, maybe less than 1% of patients will have a severe response to tinnitus. In some cases, unfortunately, this might cause some patients to have severe levels of anxiety or depression that go along with the presence of tinnitus, which can cause them to, in some cases, unfortunately, take their own lives. And so we want to respond to these patients and reassure them that there are many things that we can do to help manage this symptom, to help address this symptom of head noise that they experience. And so there are lots of interventions that are out there, and specialists that can help them with this.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you were talking, Dr. Fisher, I was recalling my this morning when I got to work, I sat down, and I was just fine. And then I was going through my notes for today, and then I came upon our part about tinnitus, and immediately I could hear. I couldn't hear it until I saw the words, there it was.
Yes, yeah, indeed. For your listeners, I developed tinnitus in my late teens, and have had ringing in both ears for over 30 years of my life now. And not that I'm necessarily the case example for everybody, but I'm at a point where I don't really notice the presence of this head noise. It's so universally present in my day-to-day life. But when I stop to talk about it, when I tell patients about it, or there are some conditions that seem to make the tinnitus louder or softer, it certainly, you know, it brings it into my attention. And we want to encourage patients to, you know, to do things from a management perspective so that their attention isn't as focused about it. Exactly. Yeah.
Steve, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Cheryl in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning. Good morning. So my challenge is my boyfriend says I need hearing aids because I can't hear him when the TV is on or when the TV is on loud or if we're in a restaurant and there's a lot of other people talking or there's a band playing in the background. I do have a hard time filtering out the background noise from the person who's speaking with me. Is that normal? Because when I had my ears tested and they said my hearing is fine, but I'm not able to filter. Is that normal?
Okay, Cheryl. Dr. Fisher?
Cheryl, thanks for that question. That is a great question and one that we hear frequently in individuals, some who have more typical appearing hearing, that is that they went and had their hearing tested and their hearing might fall into what we would call normal or typical ranges. And also in individuals who do have a hearing decrease or greater difficulty hearing sounds at some frequencies. And that it's a particular challenge because in ideal circumstances, when the auditory system in the brain is working typically, we're able to filter out some of the sounds that we don't want to hear and focus on the sounds that we do want to hear, such as speech. And you gave the example of watching television or having some background noise, such as at a restaurant. And that makes hearing much more challenging. It's much more difficult for the brain to filter out that background of sound. And that often affects individuals as they get older. It's much more challenging to hear and communicate in environments with noise. And there's different approaches to trying to manage this. One is to be strategic about your environment when possible. So if the television is on and you're having a conversation, it's maybe about educating the people that you're with. So with your boyfriend, when it comes time to having a conversation at home, muting the television or ensuring that you have each other's attention before you start that conversation and reducing background noise, or ensuring that you're close to each other or in the same room and that you can see each other clearly. Those are some things that are in our control. Going to restaurants, some restaurants are louder than others. There's an interesting app that is available through the App Store called SoundPrint, which allows a recording of sound levels in different spaces in the community. And you can see some people will have, it's a kind of a crowdsourced app where you can see how loud the level was. And I was visiting relatives in Madison, and we went to a diner on Sunday morning, and the sound level was incredibly loud and very difficult for me to communicate with my family at the table. But I would expect that on a busy Friday night at a restaurant, or Sunday or Saturday morning at a diner where there's a lot of background noise. And so perhaps strategically going to restaurants or venues at times when you know that it's not going to be as loud, or maybe they have made efforts to place acoustic paneling or sound reducing surfaces are present in the venue that will reduce sound levels. In some cases, like going to live music, it's just not possible to manage that. And there are some technologies. You could talk to an audiologist or hearing instruments specialist. They can tell you about remote microphones that can be used, in which a person would wear something on the ear, and the person that you're with will use the microphone. And it's even possible to do that with some more commonly available technologies. Apple has a product called Live Listen, where some of their headphones can be used and the microphone of the phone can be used so that the person that you're with can use the microphone of your phone, and then it will pipe their voice directly into headphones. So there are some remote microphone technologies that can help overcome the noise level relative to the signal that you want to hear that person's voice. But just to acknowledge Cheryl's concern, it can be very frustrating because it seems like in a quiet setting, you can understand and hear perfectly well. But as soon as you get into noise, it can be very difficult.
Yeah. I was thinking about televisions, too. If you have a smart television, just for watching, say, live events, there's a setting that will you can choose that will dim down the crowd noise and all of the cheering and raise up the microphones of the speakers so that it's easier to hear what the announcers or the play-by-play person is talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. And you can also use closed captioning, too, for television if you need the volume to be softer but still want to be able to read, like, the news, for example.
Yeah. Cheryl, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Brent Fisher, our guest today, audiologist for Essential Health in Duluth, Minnesota. Questions for him? You can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at your ears and your hearing health with our guest today, Dr. Brent Fisher, audiologist for Essential Health in Duluth, Minnesota. Sarah emailed us, Dr. Fisher, does COVID affect hearing loss in your experience? Sarah's husband lost all hearing in his left ear after a severe bout with COVID last May.
Oh, my gosh. I am sorry to hear that. And definitely we have early in COVID, we had a number of patients that had some reports of hearing loss. And so when we early on, when we were seeing this, it was difficult for us to know whether or not this was directly related, because we will see frequently numbers of patients that come in with hearing loss in a given month. And some of them have had illnesses. Some of them have had trauma. Some of them maybe had nothing at all that we can identify as potentially contributing to their hearing loss. And so with that, it's sometimes difficult to know whether there's a strong link between those two. But there have been some studies that have looked at this. They're relatively small studies and case reports. And so at this point, we're not certain that there's a strong causal link between COVID and hearing loss. There's correlational data showing that, you know, it seems like a number of people with COVID have also had an associated hearing loss with this, but then also COVID and some associated conditions such as long COVID create a lot of problems for individuals in terms of their the systemic health, and that it's the case that the ear is highly sensitive to changes that occur in the body. And so it's possible that there's an inflammatory response that happens in the ear, or that there's some direct viral damage. The virus can get into those sensitive inner ear structures or into the auditory nerve and causes some damage. So we're not at the point at which we can say, for certain, we know that COVID causes hearing loss, because a lot of individuals have had COVID and have not had hearing loss. But we know that there are certainly a number of people who have had COVID and then who have gone on to develop a hearing loss during that period. And we have suspicions about the potential mechanisms of that. We're still working from a research standpoint to establish that causal connection.
Let's turn to Sandy in Eagle River next. Sandy, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks, Larry. I love your show, and I really appreciate being able to ask this question for my husband, who has had really hearing loss in one ear since childhood. But he has had tinnitus all his life. It's something that, you know, is getting worse and worse as he gets older. He does use the sound machine at night to block out that ringing. But he did go to get a hearing aid because he realized the other ear, you know, he's starting to lose some hearing. And we went to our doctor and hospital clinic. They said he had profound hearing loss. So we went to a well-recognized ear hearing aid company, and he did get a $5,000 hearing aid that just made the tinnitus louder. So I'm wondering about a hearing aid for someone who does have severe tinnitus.
Hmm. What do you think, Dr. Fisher?
Oh, that is difficult. Sandy, thanks for your question. That sounds like a really difficult situation. If I understood correctly, her spouse has a long history of hearing loss in one ear and some difficulties with ear ringing, and went to obtain a hearing aid in the hopes that hearing aid would help improve potentially, I would assume, a hearing acuity, and then with a hope also that it would reduce the experience of head noise or tinnitus. There's a lot to unpack in this situation, and every person with tinnitus is kind of an individual experience. It's hard to really generically apply therapies and approaches to large groups of people with tinnitus, because individuals experience this on such a different scale. I fully acknowledge that I have had patients in this same situation in which the presence of hearing loss and tinnitus have confounded their ability to communicate effectively, and the tinnitus has been at a level that it's been very bothersome to them, to the degree that they've taken some steps to pursue different therapies like sound therapy, as she indicated there, he's using. And we have attempted to use a hearing device, like a hearing aid, and it has not gone well for that individual. And so we back it up and look at the range of management strategies that are available. There's not a universal cure for treatment of tinnitus. The kind of approach that we pursue is managing the experience, trying to reduce the perception, the distress, and the impact on the quality of life. And that includes education and counseling, sound therapies as he's using. We find strong evidence for using cognitive behavioral therapies. So we work with our health psychology specialists here within our health system and regionally to support improving quality of life and reducing things like distress and attention on that head noise that a person is experiencing. And there are also new therapies emerging, like neuromodulation, where there are some clinicians using a kind of magnetic stimulation or bimodal stimulation or vagus nerve stimulation. These are therapies that are under investigation. But there are the point I'm making is that there are lots of other therapies out there, and then also there are important things to look at, like your overall health. Sleep hygiene, stress reduction. It sounds like the specialists that they worked with looked at management of hearing loss, but that is also an important step for listeners who maybe haven't looked at that. Making sure to reduce noise exposure and addressing any mental health issues that might be present. These are different things, not necessarily specific to Sandy's spouse, but these are different things that we talk to. We want to lay out all these different options for individuals because it's such a unique experience unto that person, and it's not just one therapy that's going to work the best for everybody.
You know, I was thinking about the hearing aids themselves, and somebody who works in audio a lot, I know that I can tamp down the higher frequencies if I want and raise up the lower frequencies. And in fact, back in the day, the microphones were designed in such a way that they flattened out the higher frequencies, which was why in the early days it was tough for women to get on the air because their voices sounded flatter because microphones were invented for men. That's an aside. But what I'm getting at is, isn't there a hearing aid that, or couldn't a hearing aid be adjusted to tamp down the highest tones that typically is what a tinnitus sound is?
Yeah, absolutely. Hearing aids can be customized to the individual, and it might be counterintuitive. Many patients have high-frequency hearing losses, and so the tendency for clinicians is to try and stimulate those high-frequency sounds. But as you note, sometimes that can be counterproductive in a person with ringing, humming, buzzing noises that are bothersome. And in some cases, patients will actually benefit from a hearing device that has a little bit of amplification or gain for low-frequency sounds. That's going to bring up the background noise. It's going to mask some of the sound that potentially is bothersome to the individual. And so, yeah, absolutely, that's a great point that we can preferentially select different frequencies and program them to be louder or softer across the range of human hearing.
Yeah. If I was Sandy, I'd go back to that hearing aid company and say, hey, can you adjust this $5,000 hearing aid so that and just give it a try. You know, what's there to lose? Sandy, I hope you'll do that. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And also, keeping in mind the other points that Dr. Fisher mentioned of a broader nature in terms of dealing with it. Susan in Athens, we'll go to you next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
I do have some hearing loss, and I'm looking at the local ENT recommended the old-fashioned kind of hearing aid that goes behind my ear and then, you know, and around and in front. I have been receiving ads about this new disappear-in-your-ear hearing aid that was made in Germany. And I asked the people at ENT about this, and they said, oh, people don't like that. It's, they feel like they got something in their ear. Well, of course. But these ads make a big differentiation about clarity of hearing. And that's my chief problem is, you know, watching the TV or in a group, the clarity of hearing is what I sense as far as my hearing loss. So I want them to discuss those new kinds of hearing aids.
All right, Dr. Fisher. And by the way, Susan, what's the, do you know the name of that company, that hearing aid?
I think it was Horizon One.
Okay, something like that. Anyway, okay, Dr. Fisher?
Susan, thanks for that question, and I'm glad you brought devices that are out there on the market now. In fact, there's a class of hearing devices over the counter that are available and can be purchased online or local big box retailers now. The first thing maybe to that would be worth mentioning, Susan indicates there's a difference between types of hearing aids, aids that go behind the ear, hearing aids that go in the ear. These are different classes or styles of hearing aid. And presently about 85% or more of the market right now is in what we call receiver in the canal behind the ear hearing aids, where there is a small part of the hearing aid that holds the battery and the chip that's inside there and the other technology. And then there's a wire or little tube that goes down and something that goes into the ear. And that makes up the large majority of the market of hearing aids. And then there's a class of hearing aids that just go into the ear. There's nothing that sits behind the ear. And it might be a little bit bigger. It might fill more of that bowl-shaped part of the outer ear. We call that the concha. Or it might also go down into the ear canal. It might just be in the ear canal itself. Those are hearing devices that we call in the ear or in the canal hearing aids. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both of those systems. And we talk about that when we counsel patients about different types of hearing losses. Some individuals have high frequency hearing losses, some have low, some have a combination of hearing losses. And there can be advantages in terms of the ability to put the device even on the ear and take it off of the ear. So just to differentiate those different styles of hearing aids, one that goes behind the ear or one that goes in the ear. One of the advantages of the in-the-ear style of hearing aid, which it sounds like Susan is more interested in, it's one piece, and it's a little bit easier to place into the ear and position in the ear. The microphones of the in-the-ear devices are at about the same level as the ear canal, and so we can take advantage of some localization features of the ear itself. The ear is, the outer ear is like a satellite dish, so it picks up sound a little bit more effectively from in front and not quite as well from behind. And that can help us hear a little bit better in a noisy environment when the sound is behind us and the person we want to hear is in front of us. One of the disadvantages of an in-the-ear hearing aid is that it's something that completely plugs up the ear canal typically. We might have a little bit of a vent or an opening in the ear hearing aid that can allow sounds to come and go, but it does give a little bit more of a plugged up sensation. And one of the experiments that I've done here clinically is I will fit a patient with a behind the ear hearing aid for hearing loss and an in the ear hearing aid for hearing loss, and I will ask them to compare. And for patients with high frequency hearing losses, that is that they can hear better in the low frequencies, but they have more hearing loss in the high frequencies, they report a better sound quality with the behind the ear style of hearing aid. And I think that's probably why a larger market share of the hearing aids tends to be in the behind the ear hearing aid. So that might be just to give some rationale to the ENT sharing with you that a behind the ear hearing aid might be preferred, could be why, if that is the type of hearing loss that Susan has. I don't know. But the over the ear, there's a wide variety of outcomes that we're seeing in the literature, in the research literature, with the over-the-counter types of hearing aids. You mentioned this is coming from Horizon One. Some people have had good experiences with these hearing aids, and then some people have been frustrated, and it's difficult to know specifically what hearing aid is working well to amplify sounds in a way that would be most beneficial for the end user. There are some websites out there that have research that's available to consumers to look up some of these devices. One of these is, I believe, Audiology Informer. That's an industry newsletter that publishes information about different hearing devices. You can look at their website, Audiology Informer or Hearing Tracker. Also, hearingtracker.com has information about some hearing aids. But by all ways of disclosure, I am not familiar specifically with the hearing aid that this caller is asking about, so I can't speak to the benefits of it. But what I can say is that because of the wide variability with some of these online ordering hearing aids, it's difficult to make a recommendation either to say this would be a good idea or potentially that hearing device may not be the most ideal, just because I don't have a familiarity with all of the over-the-counter devices that are out there. But hopefully that gives a little bit of information about the differences between in-ear and behind-the-ear. And then the last thing I'd like to mention is with regards to the clarity of hearing. This is a complaint that we hear frequently. And in human hearing, we think about human hearing as being across a range of frequencies or pitches, like on a piano keyboard, from low pitch to high pitch. Typically, when there's a hearing decrease, a person is not able to hear effectively some of the pitches, more frequently the high frequencies, but it can be also sometimes the lower frequencies. When we try and help people, we're trying to give them some of those sounds back to improve the clarity of speech. So hopefully with a hearing device that's going to make sounds louder, it will, in any case, improve the clarity of hearing.
Good points there, Dr. Fisher. Dr. Brent Fisher, our guest today to talk about hearing issues. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, you'll hear about the study of oceanography here on Earth and on other exoplanets. Then we'll talk about the mission to free stuck space rovers, and you'll get an update about blue-green algae blooms in Wisconsin waters. Right now, we're looking at hearing with our guest, Dr. Brent Fisher, audiologist with Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota. It's great to have him back with us, and looking forward to hearing your comments. And Jesse in Sparta has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Gary. Guys, glad that you picked up my I've been dealing with hearing loss since age 29. I went deaf in my left ear, and essentially I've been dealing with that tinnitus for a long time. And my dad is a huge study and a huge fan of a guy called David Eagleman. If any of the listeners want to get into that research, he's a neuroscientist. And he does a lot of research on all of this. Our brain is kind of a plug-and-play type of deal. Long story short, I picked up his NeuroSensory as his company, and I'm wearing what he has for sale there, which is a Clarify, and it gives a buzz for certain frequencies and sounds that are hard for the ear to hear. And with that, paired with my hearing aids, it really works quite well. And I just wanted to give a shout-out to David Eagleman and his company, NeuroSensory, for doing that. And then for people, I've been dealing with tinnitus my whole life. One of the things I really get help with at night is brown noise. Instead of white noise, brown noise is a little bit more calming. And then when the hearing aids don't work, if people want a more affordable option besides hearing aids, the AirPods Pro, that's for sale typically in most stores for like $260, really does a nice job as a makeshift hearing aid. The only problem with it is it picks up all of the sounds and makes all of the sounds louder.
Yeah. Jesse, thanks for calling. Dr. Fisher, comments?
Oh, that's a great point. And Jesse, thanks so much for your call. I think that this new approach to tinnitus is really exciting, and kind of falls into this what we would call neuromodulation approach, where we're bimodally stimulating the nervous system. So a hearing aid is going to stimulate with sound, but there are lots of other receptors in the nervous system, like touch receptors, which we have all over our body, that we can take advantage of to help with the perception of bothersome tinnitus. And so this device, the NeuroSensory Duo, if I'm understanding this or remembering this device correctly, is a wearable type of device where you pair some sound therapy with the synchronized vibration, which I think stimulates these touch receptors. So it's a like a wrist worn device, if I remember correctly. And some studies on this have shown significant reductions in tinnitus severity in clinical study. I will mention that when we evaluate somebody who has head noise, we typically evaluate their hearing and ask questions about, for example, how long have you had this? Did it come on recently? Is this occurring in one ear or both ears? Is it steady or is it pulsatile? Does the sound that you hear sound like your heartbeat or whooshing sound, or is it kind of a steady, high-pitched tone? And then we also evaluate by giving them some questionnaire or questionnaires. One is the Tinnitus Handicap Inventory. This can be found online, where we can quantify how bothersome tinnitus is for the individual. You can also find more information on this at the American Tinnitus Association. But once we have identified some aspects of the individual's tinnitus, then a therapy like this NeuroSensory device can be applied. And in the studies that have looked at this, have showed a significant reduction in tinnitus severity. And so when we give a patient a questionnaire before they come in and then we apply some therapy, we can give them that same questionnaire again months after and look to see, has there been any change for the better or for the worse in some cases to the severity of tinnitus? So yes, this is an exciting approach to development. There are other similar devices out there, like the Lanier device, But I would endorse looking at some of these bimodal sensory stimulation devices for therapy for patients who are not necessarily responding to just a hearing aid, for example, or just to a sound therapy.
Mm. Jesse, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Dave in Appleton next. Dave, hello. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. So I've got two questions. The first one deals with the tube in the ear that removes excess moisture. I think it's called a cessation tube. Mine has narrowed to a point that I was getting ear infection. So I had to have tubes installed in my ears. I'm wondering, where does this fluid go once the tube removes it? And then I was told that after about 2 years, these tubes fall out, and I can have another one installed if the cessation tube isn't working properly at that time. Does that mean that the cessation tube can heal itself after a certain length of time? And the other question is, how many times, the other part of the first question, how many times can I have these tubes installed safely? And then the second question is, I was told that there is a surgical procedure that puts a balloon up this cessation tube and expands it, and then the balloon is deflated and taken out. How successful is that surgery?
Okay, lots of things there, Dr. Fisher.
All right. Thank you, Dave, for that call. And just a little bit about the anatomy of the ear that we haven't necessarily delved into. But the ear, we think of the ear in three parts, outer, middle, and inner ear. The outer ear is the part of the ear that we could see on the outside of the body and the ear canal, the tympanic membrane, and behind our eardrum. And behind the eardrum is an air-filled space that we call the middle ear. It houses the tiny bones that help transmit sound to the inner ear. And it also is where we have a connection with the back of the throat via a tube called the eustachian tube. The eustachian tube opens and closes typically when we're chewing or talking or yawning sometimes. It equalizes pressure in the middle ear. But for a variety of reasons, that tube can not work as effectively. There can be inflammation or infection that gets in there, and that decreases the function of that eustachian tube. The middle ear then can fill with fluid. Sometimes that fluid can get infected, and it can create problems such as a temporary conductive hearing loss. And as Dave mentioned, one of the methods of treatment is to place a small grommet or pressure equalization tube into the ear, through the ear canal, into the eardrum, and that will temporarily act as a pressure equalization opportunity for that middle ear space and allow fluid to drain from the middle ear. So the listener's question, where does that fluid go? That fluid in the middle ear will drain out of that PE tube and out into the ear canal. And most of the time, it will, if there's persisting fluid, it will drain out from the outer ear. In some cases, when there's, particularly we see this in children frequently, when they have persisting infections in the middle ear, we might see a bit of fluid that actually comes out of the ear canal. We can see it in the outside of the body or when we look into the ear with a special light called an otoscope. And the listener's next question was how many sets of these tubes can be placed, and there's not necessarily a limit, but we don't necessarily want to also be placing these tubes over and over again because it can create some problems for the eardrum over a long period of time. The tube is, as the listener indicated, designed to fall out after a period of time. The eardrum will, in most cases, heal itself and push that tube out. The eustachian tube, we hope, returns to normal function. It will return to that opening and closing function when we yawn or chew or are talking, and then that will equalize pressure in the middle ear and allow fluid that might be in the middle ear space. The middle ear space is lined with a mucous membrane, so there's some fluid naturally in the middle ear, although the middle ear itself typically we think of as being air-filled when working normally. So the eustachian tube, to answer the question, can heal itself over time, but in some individuals, this problem of eustachian tube dysfunction will persist. And when it does persist and we're not finding that we're getting good therapeutic resolution of the eustachian tube dysfunction, balloon eustachian tube dilation can be used, which is a procedure that involves the ear surgeon, typically an ear, nose, and throat provider or an otologist, will place a little catheter with a deflated balloon, typically through the nose and into the eustachian tube. And then they inflate that for several minutes, widening that tube to alleviate the obstruction in the eustachian tube itself.
Dave, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry in Milton emailed us. His primary care doctor suggested he get a hearing test after discussing the possibility that dementia may be in his future. Why would he suggest a hearing test?
Well, great, great. I'm so glad that Jerry sent this question. The World Health Organization recommends that adults get a baseline hearing test at about age 50 and at a frequency of about every 5 years after, if the hearing appears typical or more frequently as indicated, if there are any problems. And one observation that has been made recently and has been looked at via research is that it seems that individuals with cognitive decline were presenting with higher levels of hearing problems than their peers who did not have dementia or cognitive changes. And as the research has progressed, there has been a stronger link now found between hearing loss and dementia. And so as it arises as a concern, when a patient mentions to their provider that they're concerned about some changes that are occurring, one of the first things they want to do is to rule out other problems. An individual with hearing loss is perhaps missing things that are being said if somebody is mentioning something important to you, such as maybe your provider has given an instruction for how many times to take a medication, and then the patient is saying that they didn't hear that or they don't remember hearing that. They want to rule out that there isn't some issue with hearing. We know that there now is an association between hearing loss and cognitive decline, and so we want to try and prevent further cognitive decline by helping patients to take steps that would benefit them in preventing this being as much of a problem or diminishing the likelihood of it occurring in the first place. And one of the ways to do that is, if we identify somebody with a hearing problem, is to treat the hearing loss with a device or an intervention to help them be more effective in their communication and keep them stimulated with sound for as long as possible.
Dr. Fisher, it's great to have you back with us. I hope we can do this again down the road. I appreciate your time very much. Dr. Brent Fisher, audiologist for Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota. Great to have him with us today. We'll get him back. And well, thanks to our team. You know, every day we've got Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. As part of the team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau.